Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at IKEA-USA.com/circular. Visit IKEA-USA.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast, brought to you by the team behind BikeRadar.com, Cycling Plus, and MBUK magazines. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe. And if you can do so, leave us a rating on your podcast provider of choice. It really helps us reach other cyclists like you.
Hello and welcome to the Bike Radar Podcast. I'm Jack Luke, Bike Radar's deputy editor, and today I'm joined by Tom Marvin, senior mountain bike technical editor on Bike Radar and MBUK, and Simon Von Bromley, Bike Radar's senior technical road writer. Simon Bromley, first with you, how are you doing today?
I'm all right. I've been a bit ill this week. I've got a toddler and he keeps making me ill, which is really annoying. I berate him every time he does it. He doesn't understand a word I'm saying, but I think he gets the vibe.
Start a podcast with a bummer note. Thanks, Simon. Tom Marvin, how are you? Jolly as ever?
Oh, always checking at me. No, all good at this end, thanks, Jack. Also feeling a little ropey this morning when I woke up, but I think I'm all right. I've done a COVID test and I am not COVID positive, so I just need to get on with it, I think.
All right, well, I hope I brighten your spirits with today's podcast, which is going to be a quick
fire
round.
How are you, Jack, though?
A quick fire round on the latest news in the world of cycling tech. We've got everything from fat bikes, yes, they still exist, to weird carbon fixed gears that existed in the early 2000s, never to be seen again, all the way through to the latest mountain bikes and weird road tech. But we are going to kick things off with the news that Trek, despite out of nowhere seemingly, has brought out a new fat bike. Now, fat bikes definitely had a moment in, say, like 2014 to 16, maybe, kind of really went quite mainstream. Lots of big brands brought them to market, and then they mostly disappeared. Now, that's not totally true, because the likes of Surly and Salsa, lots of other small niche brands still produce fat bikes and have a place in the world for sure. But for Trek to still be investing in what is a very, very niche bit of the market is quite unusual. Tom Marvin, tell us what we need to know about the new Trek Farley and give us your thoughts on fat bikes as a whole.
Well, the main news, obviously, is that there are now four versions of the Farley. It's the Farley 5, or the aluminium ones, that really have been updated, as the carbon ones stay the same. So the alu frames, they come with a rebuilt frame with slightly tweaked geometry. You've got a slightly slacker head angle. You've got slightly shorter chainstays. And they also come with a 42mm offset carbon fork. And they all come fitted out with KD Surprised fat bikes, kind of suit the kind of rider maybe who's going to go for some long distance trundles over rugged terrain.
You can't see, but I could see the sort of doubt in Tom's face as he's saying all this. A man who doesn't like bags being strapped to bikes, let alone niche bikes. So this is really amusing me.
They're for the adventure cyclist, right? So it does kind of make sense that the bikes can be kitted out in every single bag imaginable possible for your little 5 or 10 mile trundle around it. I'm jesting. They're sort of 4.5-inch tyres. They pricing is kind of keen. You know, the aluminium frame sets start at about £1,400 or $1,500. But, you know, there is obviously still a market out there for fat bikes. There are plenty of people who still get their kicks with them. And there is a time and a place for a fat bike. A good friend of ours, well, a good friend of mine and someone you know, Jack, I don't know if he's your friend or not.
I'd say so. We message each other on Instagram.
Oh, great. You're cool. Well, our friend Hugh Oliver has just completed the Iditarod 350. I believe he came third.
He's a monster. He previously won the Highland Trail 550 big bike packing race in Scotland. A genuine athlete.
Yeah, he won GB Giro last year, which is Lance Antejohn-O'Groats off-road. The man is an endurance cycling legend in the UK, or should be anyway. So, you know, and you've got to do that sort of thing on fat bikes. So there is a market out there. In the UK, I would argue that it's quite a limited market. There's not that many times and that many places where I feel a fat bike really makes sense. But there are a lot of people out there who love riding on big floaty soft tyres. So to be fair, maybe Trek are sort of, maybe there's space for one big brand to have a fat bike in the market.
Probably quite a canny move, to be honest. Before we come to you, Simon, I'm dying to hear what you think of fat bikes. Am I right in saying, Tom, that some years ago you did a fat bike race, maybe in Finland, or am I making this up?
No, you are correct. I did the Rovaniemi 350. 150? Rovaniemi something.
Sounds quite long. Go for the bigger number. It sounds more impressive.
No, it's Rovaniemi 150. 150, oh my, I should remember, I did it. Or maybe I've just blotted it out of my memory. It was a 150-kilometre fat bike race in Lapland in February. It was unsurprisingly cold. But to be honest, as an experience, it was pretty cool. And I did have to do it on a fat bike. I had a proper Gucci fat bike. Carbon this, carbon that. It was an experience.
Cool. Simon, you know, you kind of started the year saying that you were maybe kind of tickle mountain bikes a little bit this year. Would the fat bike be fitting a slot in your heart, or are you more of a hardtail kind of guy?
I mean, yeah, like I haven't ridden one, so I'm kind of not speaking from experience, but like I just think they don't seem particularly useful for someone who lives in Bristol. I mean, like, you know, maybe if you lived in America or Antarctica, you know, somewhere where there's a lot of snow, it might be useful. But I just, like, I don't know, they just seem a bit way too niche, right? But like, you know, like Tom said, that, you know, for certain people they make sense. And you could argue that super fast time trial bikes are also a little bit too niche for most people. It doesn't mean they aren't the right bike for some people.
What balanced opinions. That's what people didn't come to the podcast. That's not what people want to listen to the podcast. Jack, they want to hate.
You struck me as a person, kind of, Jack, you might enjoy a fat bike. Maybe in a previous life, you might have enjoyed.
Jack would only ride a tandem fat bike.
A tandem fat bike. And a fixed gear one at that.
A tandem fixed gear fat bike.
With bags hanging off everything.
I used to ride a lot on a rigid Niner with like, what, 2.4-inch tyres kind of thing back in the day. And that really, it was like basically a flat bar gravel bike back in the day. And I loved that. And I appreciate the simplicity.
Were you ahead of the curve, Jack?
I was ahead of the curve. Blimey. But I appreciate the simplicity that a fat bike offers. But for me, just the sort of passive suspension that's quite out of control and a bit bouncy of a fat bike, not for me. Not for the shreddy riding I do, Tom. Anyway, the fat bike lives, the new Trek Farley. There's full details of that on bikeradar.com. Of course, in the podcast description, you can head to the links to read more about that. Now, last week, as of the time we were recording this, Strade Bianche took place for 2023, and we had the big dog himself, George Scott, out there riding the event for an upcoming feature. It'll be in
Cycling. Not the pro Plus. Race, we should say.
Well, not the pro race, but the sportive. It'll be in a feature in Cycling Plus and Bike Radar soon. But while he was there, he hoovered up all the most interesting tech he could find in the pits. Simon, you had a close look at this article. Tell us what the kind of key takeaways from Strade Bianche tech for 2023 were.
So I think, you know, the kind of obvious ones are a kind of continuation of the wider trends we're seeing across the sport. And it's kind of the things you would expect, right? Like lots of aero kit, aero wheels, tubeless tyres. I think, you know, George spotted Greg Van Avermaet, who's a kind of, you know, slightly older classics rider, still running tubulars. But I think, you know, almost every team and every rider was running tubeless tyres in a kind of, you know, 28 to 30 millimetre size. So, I don't really even know if that's news anymore. I think that's just kind of like what we expect these days. Like if anything, it's more surprising that anyone was still running tubulars, really.
It's amazing that any of the mechanics can be bothered gluing them. You can imagine when old man Van Avermaet comes down to the pit, he goes, my tubulars, please.
Well, I mean, I don't know if tubeless setup's any easier. I mean, like if they're all setting up clinches, I think it would be fine. But, you know, Tom Marvin's got a few opinions on tubeless setup. And certainly when we visited the tour last year, you know, there were a few mechanics who were kind of bemoaning the idea of having to, you know, constantly keep an eye on sealant, make sure it's topped up, and, you know, running the idea of running tubeless liners, for example, you know, they absorb some of the sealant, so you have to run a bit more, and then you have to keep an eye on it, and then, like, you know, if you want to change a tire, it can be a massive faff. And so, yeah, like I'm not sure it's much less faff, but I think the performance benefits are so clear to most teams that, you know, it's worth it. One interesting thing that George spotted was that Peter Sagan, three-time world champion, was running a GRX Di2 rear derailleur, which was quite interesting. His Total Energies team is still on 11-speed Shimano Dura-Ace. They haven't moved over to 12-speed yet, and I don't know if that's just because they're not officially sponsored by Shimano and you know, buy their parts and have decided that, you know, 11-speed Dura-Ace is perfectly fine.
Could well be.
But yeah, the GRX rear derailleur has a clutch, and so presumably that would have helped with, you know, just kind of improving chain retention, offering a little bit less noise, a bit better over the kind of off-road sections. You know, I mean, ultimately, unfortunately, Sagan didn't really play a part in the front of the race this weekend. He hasn't seemed to have recaptured his best form yet. A bit of a shame considering it's his last season, but hopefully he might improve as we go further into the road season.
I think the tubeless takeover, while not a talking point in that, like, oh yeah, they're all in tubeless, like that in itself just shows that apart from a very few holdouts, it clearly will be dominant this year, which is something we've predicted on and off for a couple of years now. And now it has slowly regained. I would be curious to know, like, you know, most of these teams have tire sponsors, and the majority of them will be wishing to push tubeless tech. So how much of it is sort of choice versus, you know, the kind of wills and wishes of the sponsors? I don't know, essentially.
Yeah, I think my kind of, like, if I had to guess, I would say, like, it is a bit of both. And I think I think if you gave a lot of pros a choice, they might still be running rim brake bikes, for example, just because they want a lighter bike.
Or they want the quick tire change, a wheel change.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, so it's kind of tricky. Like riders, you know, get less choice these days in a lot of ways, but the choices that they want are not always necessarily the kind of, you know, most optimized, fastest choices. And I know that a lot of teams these days employ, you know, performance coaches and you know, people whose jobs it is to, you know, to make sure the riders are all on the fastest kit. But it's kind of difficult, like, you know, yeah, that, like, those guys can tell those riders, you should be riding this and this because it's faster. But obviously, if the rider doesn't really believe in it, you know, that kind of performance gain gets a bit lost in the kind of lack of a placebo effect. So there's a bit of buy-in as well. And I think, you know, as other successful riders all move to, you know, tubeless or, you know, narrow bars or, you know, aero wheels and aero frames, for example, then all of a sudden the rest of the peloton probably looks at that. And, you know, like, there was a time, for example, when no one would run carbon wheels at Roubaix because you just had to run, you know,
cool
Ambrosio
box set. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
They look
box
cool
set. Box set, yeah, they did look really cool, and they were super stiff and probably, like, you know, the worst wheels you could run for that race, but they were just strong. But then obviously once Cancellara won on Zip 303s, all of a sudden everyone was like, oh, you know, we can actually, yeah, we should be running aero wheels. So I think it's just kind of one of those things, like,
Tom,
there's an element of both.
A topic we've sort of revisited a few times, but from your perspective as a mountain biker, I know you like a little bit of road riding too. I don't want to dismiss your previous life, But, you know, the mountain biking world is generally far less conservative when it comes to tech innovations. And, like, the pits, for example, at the Downhill World Cups are always a real fruitful endeavour. There's always really interesting, weird stuff being trialled. And it's kind of like the norm, not the exception. From your perspective, looking at something like Strada Bianchi, or rather looking at the holdouts, like the few guys that are on tubular tires, what do you think as a mountain biker to that?
I mean, in some ways, I respect their doggedness in sort of committing to the traditions that still exist in road cycling. But there's a large part of me that sort of really thinks, oh, just get on with it. Like, there's this new tech that's come along that does make genuine improvements, and we'll, you know, like, I get there's like psychology goes on a lot of things. You know, like, there's a lot of sort of chat in mountain biking about, you know, does weight matter, or does XYZ matter, all this sort of stuff. And I think there's a psychological element that is forgotten when we have these sort of real techie chats, because actually you need to be comfortable on the kit that you're riding. And so maybe that's why sort of some traditional sort of thoughts pervade still in road cycling. But for the most part, I'm glad those arguments of like disc brakes and all this sort of jazz are disappearing in road cycling. And I'd be interested to see which ones come around in the future, you know, one by, maybe that'll make a return. There's plenty of interesting stuff that could happen in road cycling if people just get on with it, I reckon.
Well, on that kind of note, something we always are on the hunt for, Simon Bromley, I've said it many times, quite genuinely spends his lunchtimes looking at Getty images, trying to find weird tech that teams are using. And there's not been quite as fruitful a crop at the start of this year, but there have seen the odd sort of weird thing out there. My favourite so far probably being Camping Arts running the classified hub and a big giant one by chain ring. We've also seen this quite odd looking POC Tempor inspired sweep protection helmet, which I'll ask you about in a second, Simon. These sort of like tech that falls outside of the bell curve, and these very individualistic riders like, say, Taco van der Hoorn, you know, are they a distraction, or are they something we should be looking at towards the, like, for the future of road cycling tech?
I think these people like who kind of push the boundaries, whether it be, yeah, like Taco van der Hoorn and
your
people like Dan,
rider.
Yeah, people like Dan Biggum recently. But, you know, even back in the day, you know, had a famous Scotsman by the name of Graham O'Bree, who, you know, really famously pushed the boundaries and did really crazy things. And, you know, obviously, kind of like UCI didn't really like it because some of the stuff he did looked terrible, but he certainly influenced the sport. And, you know, like even Francesco Moser adopted the O'Bree position for some of his riding. I think, you know, where, yeah, Campenaerts is going, you know, with a classified hub and a big 60-tooth ring for these climbs, it's not that everyone's going to suddenly switch from 53 or 54 to 60-tooth rings, but you certainly see it across the sport that, you know, everyone kind of looked at this and, you know, just Remco started turning in his brake hoods, and now all of a sudden everyone is, you know, thinking about turning in their brake hoods and running narrower bars, and everyone's running slightly bigger chain rings. You know, like when SRAM moved to its Axis group sets, for example, it brought out its whole kind of new gearing range, and all the pros went, well, no, we want big chain rings. So they had to make them. And so, like, yeah, there are definitely trendsetters within the peloton. You know, like, because, you know, like Dan Biggum's a great example. I'm sure he would admit he is not the most powerful rider in the world, for example. Yet he was still able to beat Bradley Wiggins' hour record and take the, you know, the overall UCI hour record off current World Tour pro Victor Campenaerts. Now, you know, like, he is a really smart guy, and he is an incredibly good athlete. You know, he is a kind of world champion on the track. But I'm sure, you know, he's kind of like, you know, brain as much as brawn, right? And I'm sure, like, other people who, you know, maybe think, well, I've got a better FTP than Dan Biggum, how come I don't ride as fast as he does? You know, if they're smart, they should be looking at that and thinking, well, what can I do? Why? What are the differences?
Probably because he probably took Bradley Wiggins' record because he didn't have laces on his shoes. That's my takeaway from all of that.
Well, I think that was the era when the UCI wasn't allowing people to wear overshoes on the track. Oh, right. So Wiggins had to wear aero socks, and a lace-up shoe was probably one of the more aero options compared to something with boa dials.
All right, Simon. That is just a joke. Thanks. Never mind.
Well, it doesn't work because it isn't true.
Anyway, looking at elsewhere at kind of strange tech, you covered this new sweep protection helmet, which, like, on the face of it, it's a pretty mad looking thing. However, it, you know, is a design that we can say quite confidently has been inspired by the success of the POC Tempor. Tell us what this new helmet is and try and describe what it looks like, politely.
At Outback Steakhouse, your wish is our command. Backed by popular demand, steak and lobster at a special price starting at $19.99. Come enjoy our bold center-cut sirloin seasoned with our signature blend of 17 spices and paired with a buttery, succulent lobster tail. Hurry in to Outback Steakhouse where your steak and lobster wishes come true at a price you can't miss. Steak and lobster, starting at $19.99. No rules, just right.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
So this is the Sweet Protection, that's the brand, and it's the Redeemer 2VI MIPS. Now, as you say, like, it appears that it takes quite heavy inspiration from the POC Tempor. Now, of course, I did put that question to Sweet Protection, and they just kind of didn't answer it and said, you know, we just looked at what is the best helmet design and, you know, completely independently came to this design, which may well be true, to be fair. But it does have that kind of similar shape where, as you kind of, rather than having, you know, most kind of time trial helmets are a traditional kind of teardrop shape in some form, you know, whether it's kind of a really long one or just a kind of short bobtail one, like the kind of famous Cask Bambino that Team Sky kind of made famous back in the day. But instead of that, this one goes back from a kind of round front and then flares out towards the shoulders. You know, I don't want to be mean, but, like, you know, people make the kind of, it looks like a Darth Vader helmet, it looks like a Stormtrooper helmet, right? Now, the idea is that these kind of flares basically direct the airflow around the shoulders, and Sweet Protection enlisted the help of a guy called Kyle Forster, who is an aerodynamics expert and previously worked at Mercedes AMG Petronas F1 team. He also runs a YouTube channel on Formula One aerodynamics. And so when he popped up in the presentation, I was like, oh, I know that guy. But yeah, it's got some interesting features. It's kind of got, like, you know, multi-layer kind of shells to, you know, have kind of the right amount of, you know, protection for your head, but also not be too thick so that it has a low stack height. And, you know, that basically means it's not a big helmet. So the idea is that it doesn't kind of have a big frontal area. It doesn't have any vents, but it does have a kind of hole on the front with two channels. And the idea is that air gets kind of pushed into those two channels and then flows through internal channels in the helmet. And it's kind of accelerated by narrowing of these channels. And then that air leaves the helmet at your shoulders at a faster speed than the kind of airflow from the outside, and somehow this reduces your drag. Now, it's got, like, you know, it's all little tricks.
Sounds
like that.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's to deal with that, you know, on the POC Tempor, it has those two vents up the front, and a lot of time trial helmets have vents in that position because that kind of central area of the helmet can typically be an area where the airflow just kind of hits it and doesn't really have anywhere to go, so it can be a kind of buildup of pressure, which can then cause a little bit of drag. So you kind of need, I think, to have some sort of vent or something there to kind of stop that pressure building up. So, but they've used that in this case to, you know, as a nifty trick, the guy called it. Now, go on, Jack.
I was going to say, who will be riding with this helmet this year?
So that'll be Team Uno X. And from the autumn, we'll all be able to buy one.
I can't wait to see you in one in your local time trial. Now, Tom, the sort of shape of this helmet, we always look back to the POC Tempor and how it was used on the track, but it kind of occurred to me a while ago that we've never really talked about, you know, like Eric Barone, for example, the downhill sort of speed record guy who would kind of ride off of Mont Blanc on a, you know, crazy downhill bike, but also the kind of world of downhill skiing. Like, this is perhaps an example, if you want to really kind of reach quite far.
Wow.
Of maybe mountain bike area.
No, no, I'm going to claim it. As a mountain biker, I'm going to claim that.
That's too much of a reach.
We've been doing this for years. It's just that the UCI throttles. Yeah. The ECI throttles our aerodynamics.
Oh, we'll call one in for you then, Tom.
That's the problem on downhill now.
Call one in for Tom's trail riding. Yeah, I think there's a lot that perhaps we have overlooked from the world of like downhill skiing or ski speed records. Like they do all sorts of wild stuff like aero fairings built into the backs of legs. Now, you're not going to see that in cycling. That would all be kind of UCI illegal, and I would probably argue all the better for it, really. But in terms of the sort of like rubbery, strange suits they use and everything, I reckon there's probably stuff to be learned there. What do you think, Simon?
Well, funnily enough, actually, rubberized suits were a thing around the 2008 Beijing Olympics and were a kind of key reason why GB won so many medals at that Olympics, you know, apparently. But then the UCI banned them because they said they were too fast. So,
famously, Scottish cyclist Ben Cathrow, of course, used a rubbery skin suit at the Fort Wayne Downhill World Cup. And he said that he practiced in his normal kit. And then Chris Porter of Geometron was running the team, I think. And he was like, no, you're going to wear the kit. You're going to wear the kit. And he went into the first corner, missed his braking mark because he was going that much faster. He basically messed up the corner because it made such a difference.
Wow. How do you determine?
And he looked a bit.
For me, my question to the UCI would be: how do you determine when something is too rubbery, too kinky?
So basically, it has to have an open weave. That's it. So the fabric has to have an open weave. Now, the rubberized skin suits were basically made so that air couldn't go through them. So that, okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's but it
how
wasn't.
How do you determine that? Do you know what I mean?
Like, this I don't know. Like, I mean, like the UCI made a bespoke tool for measuring sock length, remember? So maybe they have
just bring it up to your mouth and blow, and if it makes a farty noise, it's not open weave.
I don't know, I just whatever. Well, I'm so glad I'm not a commissar.
There, I mean, you know, like the thing is, like if you check the UCI rule books, there's a thing in it on this, right? Like there are pictures of like someone wearing one of those like gloves with closed off fingers, for example, and there's like those are not allowed.
Okay.
You know, so like the UCI, there will be something in there that says like it has to have an open weave structure, and it will be, you know, like they and they'll have some way. I think, you know, even if the thing is, even if they don't have a test, so much of this stuff is just kind of subject to, you know, the commissaire at the side of the track being like, nah, I don't like it. You know,
what a laugh. Oh well. Tom, we're going to come back to you now quickly for a quick fire round of some of the latest mountain bikes that have come to market. I dare say the last few weeks have been sort of uncharacteristically busy for February, March. I've barely been able to keep up with the amount of new products. But even in the, you know, on the mountain bike side of thing, especially at the kind of mid to low end, we've seen a lot. So, after you.
Well, so I'll start with a little UK-specific one, I guess, and that is the new Caliber Rake. So Caliber is the sort of the brand that comes out of Go Outdoors, which is like a big outdoor superstore, very good value stuff. They were responsible for a number of like Caliber Bosnet, for example, which is like the OG budget full suspension bike that was actually really, really, really good. And they have just launched the Rake's £550. The geometry looks rad, like it's long, it's slack, it's low. Their marketing material's got people doing massive jumps. So that looks really cool. It's got, good kit, good shape, and it's 550 quid if you've got that little discount card that you can get from Go Outdoors. So I reckon that bike is going to fly off the shelves real quick. The other bike that was launched that I thought was kind of interesting was the new Focus Raven. So the Raven was Focus's like arse up, head down, steep XC race bike. And I was like, oh, there's a new Raven, because I'm actually going to be doing a group test for Bike Radar and MBUK of very racy hardtails. And I was like, oh, great, I'll get the new Raven. And then it turns out it's basically a downcountry bike now. So 120 mil travel on the front, which is kind of like the new thing in XC anyway, but it is quite slack. And they seem to be focusing it at the bike packing market. Now, there's a picture on bikerider.com that we used showing Its bikepacking potential, and it's a Raven with a handlebar bag and a frame bag, and it basically looks like someone's gone along to a building site and found some rubble bags made some.
It does.
It really does.
I hadn't seen that.
It's not.
It must be made of recycle. It must be recycled. It's quite weird.
That's great. It's great. It's just not a great look. So it actually looks pretty cool, that bike, and I'd actually really like to ride it. Comes with a dropper. Comes with 120 mm forks. It's got dropped seat stays to give that compliance. A little bit reminiscent of the new Cannondale Scalper hardtail as well, which I am going to be testing. So it looks kind of cool, looks kind of interesting, but maybe not like a hardcore race bike anymore.
I was thinking, one thing I was going to say about Focus, I think their sort of design language, to use a very hot word at the minute, has really improved in recent years. Like that's a cool looking bike, and like the Focus,
it's quite BMC, isn't it? Especially at the stem.
Like, it's just got nice shapes. It's quite unified within like the wider brand. It kind of makes me think a bit like that Focus Atlas I tested a couple of years ago. Like they've really tightened up, I think, how their bikes look, and they feel very modern. Cool paint.
I think they have
nice looking bike.
Yeah, that as you say, Simon, the BMC two-stroke, another similar looking bike, and maybe I should do a test of those instead of my proper racing bikes, but anyway, I have.
It's got integrated cables, Tom. How do you feel about that?
This is a whole other podcast, Simon. Now traditionally I would be very, very, very upset about this, because I'm very bad at working on bikes, and it's one of my least favorite things is to spend time in the garage trying to fix these things, but I recently rerouted brake and gear cables through the back of my Merida 140, and it has through the headset cable routing. You know what? It took a little while, but it wasn't difficult, and it's made me reframe my thoughts on internal cable routing a little bit. But it's cool. Oh, it's also a hardtail that has one of those little down tube storage boxes, which you don't really see many of. So it's interesting.
That's something I asked.
What do people put in there?
Hot dogs.
Burritos, jackets.
Right, okay.
I rode the Specialized Stump Jumper, the like previous generation one, when that launched, and a real good like 3-4 days of riding. I put a sandwich in there. I put a jacket in there. It was great. And also the sort of little tool pouch that was in there, as someone who's chronically forgetful, it was terrific having it all sort of stuffed away down there. I'm all for it, because there's very little disadvantage to it. I think the sort of chambers themselves can be quite rough. That'd be my only sort of like feedback. And I've had a few problems with like the Spesh Diverge.
Do you like it to be velvet lined, perhaps?
Velvet lined, yeah. The Spesh Diverge had two long bolts on the bottle cage.
You're just mentioning this because you're going to say, oh, but they fixed it after reading my review.
Well, because the new one was just as bad. It wasn't just as bad, it was almost as bad. But it would catch the jacket or whatever as you took anything out. I'm all for it.
Okay.
I think there's no disadvantage. Think,
I'm more for it than I am putting a bag on your top tube or on your handlebars. I think it looks. I'm more for like a clean aesthetic. I run a top tube bag on my gravel bike because sometimes you just need to carry stuff. But it's gravel,
man.
You got your 10,000 gels.
Yeah, but
all sticking out like a triathlete. You just sellotape them on the top tube so you can have them very,
whip
very
them
quickly.
Off them as I ground along some gravel tracks.
And throw it on the floor, discard the wrapper on the floor.
I don't mind a little down tube storage box. I don't know if I'd ever really use them, but maybe to say it's good for those things where little and inoften use. I don't know if I'd put a sandwich in there because I forget it.
I don't think inoften is a word.
I can see the idea of storing a toolkit in there, to be fair. I think that would be what I would do, because I do use a saddlebag, obviously. And like, I suppose if I had a frame storage port, I would just shove it in there.
Right, final new mountain bike, Tom. One you were slightly less enamoured by, the new Audi e-bike, which if you look quite closely, might just be a rebranded Fantic.
It does look like it, doesn't it? You know, like a lot of car brands, you know, they're making a lot of noise about new electric cars. I think they're going to be quitting making, regular petrol and diesel cars very soon in the next couple of years. And I think they're trying to give the impression of creating a more holistic approach to electric transport. And they've released, it's basically a rebranded Fantic, isn't it? And they've slapped their Qtron branding on it. Inspired by their 2022 Dakar-winning Qtron car thing that drove across the deserts really fast and did look quite cool. So they've made a bike. There'll probably be in a lot of Audi car dealerships on a bike rack on top of the car, destroying any aero efficiency that their electric cars may have and reducing your range significantly. But it's a thing. It looks fairly expensive. They've plugged on a load of Olins, so like real fancy kit on there. It's just not much of a looker.
I just, for me with car brands, like it feels, oh, I don't know, like no one's nailed it really. Like no one's nailed it as like producing bikes. I feel like it will come. Like car brands can't ignore, or car manufacturers, I should say, can't ignore that cars are going to be banned from city centres eventually. That's the kind of key thing there. And it would make sense for them to invest all this wonderful manufacturing and engineering expertise they have into bikes. Of course, they're not directly applicable, and we've seen that with some
Porsche, BMW, they've
bikes
all done it
from car brands in the past. But they always, but for the most part, they tend to be these sort of just rebranding exercises. And it's kind of disappointing, to be honest. I'd rather see someone really, really go out there. And we talked about it in a previous podcast, Simon, but like we, to kind of get to the mass market, I personally believe a car brand coming in with its huge distributor model, all these garages absolutely everywhere, they have the presence already to make owning a bike more like a car. Now that, for the people listening to this podcast and us, like that's just not how we would own a bike. It's not what we're interested in. But most people don't really care about things like how easy it is to service a bike. They just want a bike that will work. And I think for a car brand to come in, invest in developing something genuinely good and make use of what they already have in terms of physical presence in the world would probably be a good thing.
What I do like from the car world is, you know, like so far no one's made a decent, none of the car brands really have made like a decent bike. But you are seeing car brands accepting that cycling is an important aspect. So, you know, Skoda, for example, have done, you know, whether it's concepts or they do little bits to make living with a bike a little bit easier in some of their bigger cars. I think it was this Vauxhall Corsa had like, you could get an integrated bike rack sort of locked out of the bumper. So, you know, I like it when car brands accept that cycling is important and they encourage their drivers to, you know, or they offer products to make life a little bit easier for cyclists, because all that does is increase like cycling's presence in the mainstream, because most people, you know, a lot of people really don't know that much about it. But, you know, if the car brand's like, hey, look, you can do this with your car, you know, you can get a bike and it really is, it's like there's a rack integrated, that's only going to encourage people who maybe wouldn't be that interested in cycling to maybe think about it.
What do you think, Simon? Are you sympathetic with that feeling, or are you slightly more sceptical?
I just don't really like it. You know, I think this idea of like, you know, I think when car manufacturers, you know, build the sports utility vehicles, it's kind of like, hey, isn't like, you know, driving fast is really, really fun. And, you know, I'm going to get this car with a massive, powerful engine and it's huge. And this just kind of feels like the bike version of that, like £8,500. And it's just kind of like, it's like, it looks like one of those kind of homemade e-bikes you see like delivery drivers running around on. And I just think like, this isn't what we need for kind of like utility cycling. And they can say like, oh, well, you know, it's a sports bike and it's not intended for kind of, you know, urban riding and stuff like that. But then I just don't think, you know, what are Audi doing trying to get into that space? If so, they're kind of, you know, Audi makes cars for, you know, transport and everyday use. So I don't really see, I don't know. I just don't like it. I think like, I don't know. I think car manufacturers have done enough damage and they should just kind of like go away. And, you know, this is someone who like owns a car, you know, and I have a secondhand SUV, so maybe that's a bit hypocritical, but I didn't buy it, you know, because I wanted that kind of car. It was kind of just a hand-me-down because it had come to the end of its useful life with my parents and I just needed
Simon,
a kind of slightly
Simon,
bigger car.
What are the listeners going to think? A hand-me-down SUV?
Well, I mean, like, yeah, but like, you know, would you, like selling a car these days is like, obviously you can get decent money for it, but you know, we had a terrible old car. We just needed a slightly bigger one. It wouldn't be the type of car I would choose if I was, you know, going out to buy one, but but yeah,
well, we know
I
that
don't
you
know.
Love hanging outside of primary schools, revving the engine, parking on the
yellow zigzags. Yeah, but that's the thing, you know, like this just feels like a kind of SUV bike, and like SUVs are kind of all that's wrong with the modern world. So yeah, it's just not really my cup of tea. Maybe it's a fun bike if you were riding in Dakar, but for the kind of streets of Bristol, it just looks a bit silly.
From one wildly impractical bike to another, we now turn to Erik Björling, who is Trek's head of road marketing. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I wrote an opinion piece on the Trek District Carbon, which was an utterly weird fixed-gear belt-driven bike that absolutely nobody needed. Ludicrously expensive, wildly niche. Return to my chat with Eric now. I'm now joined by Eric Bjorling, who is Trek's Director of Brand Marketing and PR. Now, Eric, you were involved with the District Carbon's development, or certainly part of that team, way back in the day. But first off, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do at Trek today, and your involvement with that project way back when.
Sure. I have this kind of overly lofty title of Director of Brand, and really what it means is I get to guide the efforts of a really talented group of creatives. So that covers everything from photo studio and video studio. A lot of our web content, our creative designers in graphics, and our copywriting team, as well as our communications department as well. So it's a lot of different things, but I kind of like to think that we sort of run the little miniature creative agency with and have just one really demanding and consistent client.
You sound like a very, very busy man.
It does keep me up and busy.
So back when you worked on the Trek District, I mean, first off, just tell us what that bike was for the people who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. You know, back in 2009, I was still making my way at the company. I started here in 2005, so this will be my 18th year. We're going into my 18th anniversary here, which I'm very excited about. But at that time, I was the marketing guy for the pavement line. So really, like, non-competitive. It was cruisers and kids bikes and urban bikes. And urban bikes were having this like moment in our culture and in just like relevance. It was really incredible to see. People were kind of returning to the bike paths, and cities were starting to, at least here, especially in the US, it's a very different story abroad, but cities in the US were really starting to wake up to the importance of cycling infrastructure. And cycling kind of became fashionable again. And so we were doing a lot of different experimentation and a lot of different kinds of bikes than Trek had ever done before. But it was this really great period where you had an incredibly creative team of individuals that was working on these bikes, really plugged into the culture and really plugged into what was happening in New York and in LA and going, doing all these research trips. And we brought back a lot of this stuff into the team. And the District Carbon specifically came out of a lot of different conversations that just started with like, what if? Hey, like, what if we took this frame, or what if we tried this, or what if we took some of our favorite elements from other places and just kind of mashed them together and did something really, really different? But then, you know, you have those what if moments, and then you're like, well, what if the bike actually costs like, you know, $3,000, $5,000 for a single speed? What if that happens? And it's like, well, that actually did happen.
So, you know, for those that don't know, the District Carbon was, if I'm right in saying, based on the Madone of that time. But among many of its other quirks, and I do outline these in the article I wrote for Bike Radar, it was, as you say, a belt-driven single speed. Now, that is a pretty wacky combination between the two. You know, it's a niche bike within a niche sort of segment. My big question for you is, why a belt drive? You know, given that single speeds are generally speaking used as a chain, what kind of led you to decide to use a belt drive?
Sure. You know, we had had our eye on belt drives for a couple of years. They were really starting to get to a place where we were really comfortable speccing them on bikes that we were selling in stores. We had a bike at the time. It was called the Soho. It was a 3-speed internal hub drive belt drive. And we really liked actually the performance. Retailers really liked the simplicity. The belt drive system was really like had reached a level of quality that like consumers were really starting to have a lot more confidence in it as well. And it was really light. That was kind of the cool thing. It was really, really light. And so when we started these what if conversations, it's like, what would the lightest single speed? What would the goofiest thing that you could build? Well, you could take the best Madone frame from that era, and if you paired it with a belt drive. And then you could do, if you paired it with a couple of you know, other light, you know, handlebars and a lot of the other parts, you could actually have one of like the highest end, lightest, maybe single speed urban styled bikes ever made. And then we had somebody on the team who actually just said, well, let me give it a shot and I'll make a prototype and we'll see how it goes. But the biggest thing is like, when we looked at it, you're like, okay, yeah, how are you gonna like, cause the chainstay was gonna be our biggest thing. It's like, how are you gonna, cause a belt drive needs a split dropout. And at the time, the Madone didn't have a split dropout. There was no, like, we didn't have a solution for that. So that was the first thing that they had to conquer in the prototyping phase.
So that was going to be one of my questions. I've heard rumor over the years that the bike used quite an unusual way of tensioning the belt. So the majority of single-speed bikes or belt-driven bikes will use a sort of horizontal dropout or a track end, if you prefer, which moves the wheel fore and aft, and that tensions the belt. The District Carbon used a different arrangement where the axle spun concentrically around the sort of middle of the dropout, essentially like an almost like an eccentric bottom bracket, but replicated at the rear. Now, I've heard rumor over the years that this eccentric dropout was based on components used from Trek's ABP suspension system. First off, is that true? And secondly, why on earth did you use an eccentric dropout?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, again, I will caveat, as being the marketing guy, they don't tell me everything. And it's probably, you know, some things that I don't know that are probably the most valuable for me. But, you know, we did borrow a couple of learnings from other places. You know, the way that we were able to do belt drives before was because we were working with aluminum frames. So you could actually separate that dropout point. So we did look around for inspiration in other places where they had actually successfully created a system like that. You know, ABP was one of the places that we took a look at because they had created a system that essentially was doing exactly sort of what we needed it to do at the time. So there were definitely things and learnings that we borrowed from other parts of the business. The great thing about, you know, the industrial design and the engineering teams at Trek is that they work really closely hand in hand. There's a lot of shared learning and knowledge. And so there's a lot of, I see what you guys are working on. Have you thought of this or have you tried this? And that was probably pivotal to actually making the District Carbon a reality.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely sort of sets it apart from other bikes where lightweight single speeds have existed. But I think the sort of quirkiness of it is what really cemented it. Gave it a place in my heart.
Sure. Well, I saw your article. There's a few bikes that I get to work on that I really do have this kind of like, I have a really deep affinity for, because you work on so many bikes after a while. They you know, you love all your children, but there's some that you just love a little bit more than others. And the District Carbon was one of those things where it was so different. It was so silly. And in the volumes were going to be so low. But they still said, yeah, like for a lot, you know, a lot of times, you know, Trek is at a scale where you have to reach a certain, you know, volume to make it all feasible and make the business, you know, a business. That was one of the things that they kind of said, you know what, this looks so fun and different and interesting and let's give it a shot. And the volumes were really low, but, the bike was so different. And so, you know, we hand numbered them. We had enough like control over the process where we could actually do a topical decal and we could take each one off the line and hand number it and make sure that, you know, and kind of treat it with a little bit different care because it was just kind of a different product.
Just off the top of your head then, with that question in mind, can you roughly say how many of them you produced and ideally how many you sold and whether you've got one hiding in a warehouse somewhere that I can just have?
Yep. I think I'm trying to remember. I don't think we made more than that many more than 100.
Wow.
I think it was we really did try to keep that one really like low. And I'm trying, because I have had people reach out to me. I know somebody over in our education department, our retail training group, has number 87. And he got it, and he's like, I got number 87. It's like, number 87, what? It's like District Carbon. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's probably pretty close to the end of like when we were making these. So it is one of those bikes. If you do find one, I highly encourage, if you're a collector or if you're into it, I highly encourage getting it. I don't have one, and I don't have one laying around. I'd love to have one for the archive, but my wife would prefer that I actually don't bring another bike into the house at the moment. So,
my final question on the bike, did you have an opportunity to ride one yourself when it was developed? And if so, I mean, describe the feeling.
Yes, absolutely. We all rode the prototype because I think we try to really put the prototypes through as much punishment as we can just to see if this is actually going to work. I remember the first pedal stroke on the prototype, and the prototype was able to use, you know, even like cut down carbon bars, things that we wouldn't necessarily like do at an OE level or a stocking level. And I remember the bike almost going out from under me because I just put a little bit more force than I thought it like than I really, really needed to, because it was so light. I mean, this bike had broke every single UCI rule that there about bike weights and everything else, but it didn't matter. You know what I mean? That wasn't really part of the design theory. We didn't have to do anything because these bikes weren't going to be raced anyway. So I remember the bike almost going out from under me because it was just way lighter than I had anticipated. And once I got it, once I kind of felt it was just one of those things that was just kind of like too fun not to interact with. and not to want to share with people. I think the team at that time was such a collection of creative and fun and just goofy people that, like, the joy of riding that bike was really, I think, what brought us to the point where, like, we just got to pitch this upstairs. We got to defend it because it's gonna get all the scrutiny. But at the same time, what it could do for the brand or what it could do just for the few people who do get their hands on this thing could be really, really meaningful.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a definite highlight for me. Trek has produced a lot of pretty weird and out there bikes over the years. And, you know, there's still highlights in the catalog, which are definitely like outside the mainstream for what is a very, very large brand. But as a sort of shining example of what you can do, given the opportunity to do what you want, I think it's a wonderful bike.
Oh my gosh. It's like, thank you so much for bringing it up again. It's one of those bikes that just kind of like, it's always kind of like under the surface, but when somebody actually talks about it or brings it up, I could spend hours talking about that time. It was great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Eric. And thanks for building such a cool bike.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jack.
Thanks very much to Eric. I really enjoyed looking back on that bike and very pleased we dredged up some of his wonderful memories from that time in his life. Right, boys, before we wrap up, any other business, anything else that's exciting, and perhaps a little update from both of you on how your Bike of the Year testing is progressing. Tom, we'll start with you.
My Bike of the Year testing is progressing okay. I was due to be out today, but the weather is terrible, and myself and Rob decided that we wouldn't really learn much if you're, you know, when you're like rattling around the woods and all you're trying to do is stay on your bike because the roots are wet and everything's muddy. And you're not thinking about what the bike's actually doing. You're thinking about not dying. So we didn't go out today, but we'll be hopefully out tomorrow up at Bike Park Wales, who are very gracious in hosting us for a lot of our Bike of the Year testing. But yeah, going all right. A couple more weeks to go. Still haven't got a clue as to which bikes are going to be in my top 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8. It's a complicated year.
You know, one of my favorite things is making fun of you for moaning about the weather. But even I have to sympathize that it is absolutely honking. It's really grim. I'm sitting here with very wet thighs after my ride in, very foolishly underdressed for my cycle in. Simon, are you also shying away from the grim weather today?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, I've got the aero road bikes category, so it's going to be even less appropriate weather for that. It's just, yeah. I've tested a few good bikes already, and so that's been good. I was kind of thinking, save some of the bikes I'm really looking forward to you know, testing for the first time for March because the weather will be nicer. Maybe not, but yeah, like we'll see. It's coming along well. I think one of the interesting things with testing road bikes is that there's, especially within, you know, a specific category like aero road bikes, is there's a high level of convergence. Really, I don't think the differences between the bikes are as big as they are. Well, you know, I expect they are amongst mountain bikes. So the kind of, you know, the differences between them are kind of, you know, more nitpicky, really. But that's fine because I love to nitpick.
Your job is to be a tech pedant. Could be your title. Very good. And just to go back, kind of look back at the news highlights from the last few weeks. Anything else that's got you excited, Tom?
You put me on the spot there a little bit, Jack.
That's what I asked you. I know. It'll be natural.
What I am excited about is there's a few new things coming out very soon that are genuinely exciting and really interesting. So I'm gonna swerve the question and say keep an eye on Bike Radar over the next sort of few weeks because there's some big news coming from a few big manufacturers of bikes and product, and it'll be hot gossip when it lands.
What a ruddy tease you are, Tom. Simon?
Yeah, so I thought that the announcement of the Continental GP5000 ASTR and the TT tyres was quite interesting. So the ASTR is an all-season version of the GP5000 STR, which is the kind of, you know, world tour level all-round road racing tyre. I thought it was weird that they went for a kind of like painted tan sidewall rather than the kind of quite nice kind of natural biscuity tan sidewall that's on the GP5000 STR, but they seem to be making some quite big claims about it, you know, sort of saying that you could use it as a kind of commuter tire, which seems, you know, it's a quite a premium tire. Like, you know, maybe there are some premium commuters out there, I suppose. The GP5000 TTTR seemed very interesting as well because the kind of tread pattern on Continental's tires is supposedly fairly aerodynamic, but they've always kind of lagged slightly behind, you know, say something like the Vittoria Corsa Speed in terms of pure rolling resistance. So it'd be kind of interesting if this can kind of match the rolling resistance of a Vittoria Corsa Speed and be slightly more aerodynamic, then this could be a really good tyre.
Very good. Well, thank you very much to both of you. Thank you for joining the Bike Radar News podcast. It's always a pleasure to go back over some of the highlights from the past few weeks. If you want to keep up with more saucy gossip, why not sign up to the Bike Radar newsletter? If you scroll down to the very bottom of the homepage, we have a newsletter sign-up widget there. And twice a week, you'll get a tasty selection of the best news, reviews, and features to come on BikeRadar.com. If you like listening to our angelic tones, then don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Give us a 5-star rating if you think those angelic tones were worth listening to. And if you have any feedback, questions, or comments, send those through to podcast@bikeradar.com. They're very helpful. We always enjoy them. And they're very good inspiration for future episodes of the podcast. Simon and Tom, thank you very much for joining me. And I'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Radar podcast. If you've not done so already, please subscribe and share with your friends, or leave us a rating if you've enjoyed this episode.